Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. On this Labor Day weekend, we'll begin with an analysis of how American workers might be celebrating the end of summer on Labor Day with vacations. Given that about 56% of American workers took week-long vacations last year, an all-time low from the steady decline that began in the 1980s, when more than 80% took week-long vacations. Harold Meyerson, an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post, joins us to discuss his latest article at The American Prospect, A Happy Labor Day, Really?, and examine how both left-wing and right-wing populism are emerging in this election season as a result of stagnant wages and lack of economic opportunity. Then we will speak with Dr. Harley Shaken, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We will discuss the state of working America and the decline of wages and unions since the late 1970s, and whether manufacturing jobs could be returned as the service economy takes over from the manufacturing economy. We will also examine the future of American capitalism as more and more wealth is extracted by the top 1%, while less and less wealth trickles down to the bottom 99%. Then finally, we'll get an historical perspective on labor, income disparity, and race and gender in the workplace with Leon Fink, a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas, and we will discuss whether growing income inequality today is worse than it was in the previous Gilded Age, and how much globalization has lowered wages while almost all of the benefits of increased productivity go to the top. And joining us now on this Labor Day is Harold Meyerson, an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. He also writes regularly about California politics for The Los Angeles Times and other national publications. And his latest article at The American Prospect is A Happy Labor Day, Really? Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Meyerson.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
And on this Labor Day, are you really having fun?
Well, if the criterion for fun is are American workers finally doing better on anything, the answer is mixed. But mixed is better than what it's been for a long time. I mean, wages are still stagnant. The labor costs in the last quarterly document of the Labor Department advanced by their lowest amount since the early 1980s, when there was a horrific recession. So, not yet. But the other side of the coin is that in response to really, I think, general progressive realization of how dismal things have been for American workers, and in response to, broadly speaking, the really innovative campaign of fast food workers backed by the Service Employees International Union to raise the profile of low-wage work with their campaign for a $15 minimum wage, you're beginning to see some real changes through the political and administrative and judicial process. I mean, first you're getting minimum wages raised not just in, you know, the usual suspect places like San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles, but in places you wouldn't necessarily think this would happen, like St. Louis and Birmingham, Alabama, which recently voted to raise its minimum wage. And you're getting rulings from labor commissioners that deal with issues like misclassifying workers so the employer doesn't really have to pay them very much. The National Labor Relations Board recently ruled that when a company outsources its work to like a temporary employment agency or some other outsourced supplier of labor, that the workers have a right not only to unionize but to bargain with the employer at the top of the food chain. A number of years ago, I was out in what we call the Inland Empire, the area around San Bernardino in California, where there is a huge concentration of warehouses. This is where the goods that come into L.A. Long Beach Harbor, the imports, are trucked and then sorted and put on trucks for, you know, Walmarts within 1,000 miles and Home Depots within 1,000 miles and what have you. There are 100,000 people working in these warehouses, but they all work for temporary employment agencies, even though there's nothing temporary about their jobs. And this means that the Walmarts and the Home Depots and the logistics companies really don't have to not only pay these workers very much or give them any benefits, but if there are violations of safety or wages or what have you that violate the laws, these companies say they're not liable. It's a scam. It's a complete scam. And thanks to the National Labor Relations Board, these workers could now, if they unionize, bargain not just with Temporary Employment Agency X, but with the parent company, the Walmart or the Lowe's. And the California Labor Commissioner, Julie Sue, has also been holding these companies liable for violations of health and safety and wage laws. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on. I was struck by the fact, just in this last week, there's a bill before the Seattle City Council that deals with the whole Uber conundrum for workers. Now, as you know, a court has ruled that Uber drivers can place a class action suit against Uber saying they're really employees. Uber says they're all independent contractors. But the bill before the Seattle City Council takes a very interesting position that's very novel. It says, well, independent contractors may be independent contractors, let's assume they are, but they can still form a union. The logic behind this is that independent contractors are excluded from the National Labor Relations Act, the traditional way to have legal right to collective bargaining, because they're excluded alongside the other groups that are excluded, agricultural workers, public employees. But as we know, states and cities have said, okay, if the federal government doesn't have the authority to do this, they're excluded. States and cities still can. So states and cities have collective bargaining rights for their public employees, and California has collective bargaining rights for farm workers. That happened the first time Jerry Brown was governor, when Cesar Chavez was heading the United Farm Workers. So the folks in Seattle are saying, well, what about independent contractors? They're excluded in the same sentence as public employees. Maybe we can make them give them collective bargaining rights too here in Seattle, which would affect not merely drivers for, say, Uber and Lyft. It would affect cab drivers too, who are generally classified as independent contractors. So there are all kinds of things moving, and that's why this Labor Day isn't simply the usual depressing litany of the low wages, et cetera, or wages that are stagnant, but some things that are still going on that are distinctly positive.
And again, I'm speaking with Harold Meyerson, who's an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. He also writes regularly about California politics for The Los Angeles Times and other national publications. And his latest article at The American Prospect is A Happy Labor Day, Really? And you point out in your article, Harold, that, of course, Labor Day is the end of summer, and most people around in the industrial world take 2-3 week vacations, particularly in the summer. You point out about 50% of American workers took week-long vacations last summer, a new low point in a steady decline that began in the early 1980s when more than 80% took week-long vacations. So we're unique amongst the industrial countries of the world in as much as in our Declaration of Independence we have the pursuit of happiness. What went wrong here? Why is America the country where its workers work the hardest and the longest with the least vacations?
The least vacations. It's the only industrial country in the world that doesn't allow for like paid maternity leave and paid sick days. In a sense, American capitalism is perhaps the most raw and bloody you can find. Something I think we will hear in a nicer way than I just said it. We will hear Pope Francis say when he comes to America later this month. It's, I think, partly a function of the relative weakness of the union movement in America, which really was only strong in the 3 decades after World War II and has been under relentless assault from business and businesses, business-friendly politicians ever since. But rights to work on the job or social rights in America have always been less, not only than, say, European countries, which had a more vibrant social democratic or socialist tradition, more accepted, generally accepted rights for workers, but actually when it comes to things like paid sick days, paid maternity leave, we offer less than any country in the world.
So given that in the political zeitgeist now, with these Republican primaries, that you have a resurgence of right-wing populism galvanizing around Donald Trump and left-wing populism galvanizing around Bernie Sanders, do you think that's likely to affect the debate that we're having here on Labor Day, given that...
Well, I think it's plainly already affected the debate in both directions. And I think, to a certain degree, this is certainly traceable to the increasing economic plight of most Americans, not just those who would be affected by things like minimum wage regulations. I was struck, something I just saw, I noted, there are really only two European nations at the moment that have seen real wages go up since 2010, Germany and Sweden. And there are really only two European nations that are really accepting refugees right now in any substantial numbers, Germany and Sweden. And I think there is an interconnection between the way most people feel about how they're doing in life and what their prospects are, and their openness to having new people come into their country that are different. The backlash we're seeing in places like Hungary is really quite similar, I think, to what we're seeing in the Trump campaign, this kind of ugly, nationalist, racist, anti-anyone-but-Christian reaction. And I think it is tied at some level to economic conditions. I mean, the difference between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump is Donald Trump says, you know, immigrants are the source of all your problems, and he's exploiting this sense among a almost entirely white Republican Party that has racially based fears, racist fears about the racial transformation of the United States. And Sanders, you know, says, well, it's not the immigrants who are really affecting economic prospects, except for a small slice of native-born Americans. All the money is going to the top. Sanders has the advantage of being empirically correct, and Trump isn't. But that's not a deterrent, apparently, to lots of Americans.
Well, you would think, though, that the contrast, which is pretty clear, perhaps, you know, maybe we're frozen in America in these two working class narratives. On the one hand, Sanders, where you know, we've got to return labor unions and social justice, and we've got to have a, you know, stop the growing income divide and inequality, etc. Fairly traditional positions that rest of the social democracies understand and operate on. But on the other side, you've got this other, given that Trump is bringing in all these Reagan Democrats to vote Republican, he's got basically the other narrative, which is, you know, you two can win the lottery, some of my billionaire fairy dust might rub off on you, and all you need is to get motivated.
Yeah, but the Trump thing is also based on race. It's you know, you may not be doing well, but you know, the fact that you're not is really the fault of these people who are also changing what America looks like, making it no longer a white man's country. And
but by the way, Harold,
he's connecting actually even more on that level than he is on the purely economic level. But he connects the dots by saying that the immigrants are the source. But he doesn't just say the immigrants are the source of your economic woes. He blames to a degree. He blames trade and offshoring as well. And there he's got some empirical data, but it's all wrapped up still in this kind of racist viewpoint, you know, that it's these foreigners who ain't us, who ain't white folks, who are the cause of the trouble.
And how different is that from the private talk that Mitt Romney gave in the last election that was exposed, where he talked about the 47% of freeloaders, as opposed to, you know, the good, hardworking Republicans who basically subsidize the other?
Well, Mitt Romney said it in a much more indirect way than Trump said it, and part of Trump's success so far this year is his directness, actually. And you know, Romney would not have put it in this kind of really nativist racial framework, because actually that's not where, you know, the business elite is. Except in the veiled way that Romney put it, but Trump is thriving by putting it into this more racist context.
Well, he certainly made it extremely clear, because it was, after all, his opening salvo when he announced that he was running for president, that he made these outrageous remarks about Mexicans being rapists coming across the border, you know, to take over our country and all of that. But, you know, I know there's a difference, but I must say that in that speech that Romney gave, that was surreptitiously taped, where he talked about the 47% of freeloaders, the difference between the makers and the takers in America, which I think is very deep in the Republican DNA, the belief that the Democrats basically go out there and bribe a bunch of minorities in order to get elected. What Romney did say in that talk that I found alarming was that he talked about these Chinese factories where they make apples and how they put these dormitories with 12 young women in one dormitory, and they have cafeterias and they work them incredibly long hours and they never leave the plant. And it wasn't that he was talking about it in a critical way, that no wonder they're committing suicide. He actually was more or less saying, this is a really good thing. This is really efficient.
Yeah, well, and Trump isn't saying that. But Romney was sort of the unbound capitalist, the capitalist unbound. And Trump is appealing to something that I think has actually greater support among the white nativist right-leaning working class than Romney. Romney was not exactly a beloved figure to white working class voters, even when they voted for him. Trump kind of connects with them on all kinds of levels in a way which Romney didn't, and therefore I think his surge is certainly considerably more remarkable, actually, than anything we've seen in the Republican Party for years. But it's a logical consequence of where the Republicans have been going. I mean, Trump is characterologically in the mode of those kinds of right-wing talk show guys or Fox News anchors who are, the tough guy defending the white worker against all empirical evidence, be it Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I think in many ways, though, Harold Meyerson, that racism is kept alive, and I do believe it is being kept alive by the Republican Party, is simply because the last thing that they want the American worker to recognize is that, first of all, there are more white people in poverty than there are minorities, and secondly, that all workers, whatever their race, have more in common than they have in terms of differences. So it seems to be a kind of atavistic way to divide the race, the working class. So if that's the strategy, how are we doing on the other side with Bernie Sanders in terms of the better angels of our nature?
Well, Bernie is certainly touching the better angels, but he's also still a largely unknown quantity, an unknown figure to most voters outside what is really kind of the white progressive base of the Democratic Party. There's just a piece in the Sunday New York Times about how Hillary Clinton expects to weather the Sanders storm by doing very well in the all the Southern primaries, which come up right at the beginning of March. And in Southern states, the Democratic Party is overwhelmingly African American, and Sanders is still an unknown quantity there. And there's an affection for the Clintons generally, and so Bernie is doing much better than anyone, including he himself, expected. But he hasn't really broken out of the white, perhaps disproportionately young as well, progressive ghetto.
Well, curiously enough, though, on the Republican side, both Donald Trump and, you could argue, his likely running mate, Ted Cruz, and they're going to be speaking together very soon, against the Iran deal, which is somewhat futile, but nevertheless, there just appears to be some kind of an alliance brewing there between Trump and Cruz. Cruz, of course, is talking about, you know, subsidies for big business and the Import-Export Bank. And Donald Trump did say that he was going to start taxing the hedge fund guys who pay less tax than their secretaries, 15% or less, as we learned from Mitt Romney's tax returns. So is that a response to Bernie, or is that just they're just tapping into the zeitgeist?
I think it's tapping into the zeitgeist. I don't think they're responding to Bernie. Cruz, in particular, I think, is the ultimate far-right opportunist. He'll ride any horse and has ridden any horse he thinks he can get some mileage out of. No, I don't think they're responding to Bernie. I don't think there's really any crossover vote between Bernie and Trump. We're at the extremes of the American political universe here, and these are not extremes, I think, that really meet. But there are some points of commonality in that, in their own different way, Trump and Sanders recognize that most Americans understand the economy isn't working. That they accept the common premise, and then the conclusions they draw from that common premise. As you pointed out, a couple of them may be the same, but the vast majority couldn't be more different.
Well, Harold Meisen, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for joining us here today on Labor Day.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Harold Meisen, who's editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. He also writes regularly about California politics for The Los Angeles Times and other national publications. And his latest article at The American Prospect is A Happy Labor Day, Really? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the state of working America and the decline of wages and unions since the late 1970s.
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
There's a place I don't. The edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing on this Labor Day, Dr. Harley Shaken.
It's nice to be here.
And the National Employment Law Project just released a new study saying that America's take-home pay has effectively fallen since the economic recovery began in 2009, and we know that wages have been flat since the late 1970s. So on this day, do you think that idea of wages being flat, all of the gains of productivity going to the top 1%, it seems to be out there in the zeitgeist. Do you feel that we're at least making some progress in terms of raising the consciousness of the average American about income inequality?
We certainly are making, I think, considerable progress on raising the consciousness, but the numbers remain disturbing, if not surprising. It isn't simply that wages are flat or even declining in some areas, but rather that productivity has been so robust. In other words, the average worker since 1979 is producing about 78% more and earning about the same. That money or that those benefits are going somewhere, but it's not into the paycheck of a worker, into the worker's family, into those communities, and ultimately into a broadly shared purchasing power that stimulates economic growth.
Well, this phenomenon is, you know, it's been pretty evident. I mean, for the longest time, household income and productivity tracked in parallel, and then starting in the 1980s, it started to diverge with productivity going way up and household income sort of flatlining and then slowly dipping. So it's very, very evident that the gains in productivity are going to the top and not to labor. And surely we can't be locked in this dynamic forever. I mean, this is sort of classic Karl Marx at play here.
It's very disturbing. And the reality is it's painful for workers and their families, but it's in no one's long-term interest. It is in the interest of a very small minority, perhaps, in the short term. But over the long term, it does damage to the economy. It does damage to a sense of opportunity. It's just simply not healthy economically or socially. One of the key contributing factors that we often neglect in the increasingly widespread discussions about inequality is the role in the decline of unions to these disturbing numbers. Unions in a post-World War II period were the link that brought rising productivity together with rising wages, and that created the virtuous circle that we had from the end of World War II to the mid-1970s of workers earning more, buying more, the economy growing, and jobs being created. In 1980, roughly one out of every five workers was a member of a union. Right now, that's one out of nine, and if we look at the private sector, it's about one out of every 16. Those are very disturbing numbers, and it makes labor a weaker force in the society, a weaker force at the bargaining table, and it shows up in these inequality numbers.
But that didn't happen by accident, Holly Shaken. That was very much the agenda of the wealthy kitchen cabinet of Ronald Reagan, who literally financed his election. And remember, he ran three times. It wasn't as if he only got elected in 1980. And the first thing he did was fire the air traffic controllers who were on strike and instituted an extraordinary number of anti-labor laws. He, in fact, went to, even though he was a former head of the Screen Actors Guild, he went to war on labor. The other thing that he did, along with Alan Greenspan, was they introduced cheap credit so that working people and middle-class Americans could have the illusion that their standard of living is being maintained. But it's on credit as opposed to with wage increases, which have been flat since Ronald Reagan. And this, I think, has had the result of an enormous amount of indebtedness. And if you indent, if you basically indenture your working class, you make them wage slaves and much more obedient to power.
Well, I think you're raising an excellent point here that we often forget, even though we have a much larger focus on inequality today. None of this is a natural evolution of an economy just moving along, and this may be unfortunate, but that's the way it is. All of this reflects deliberate policy that was meant to redistribute income in the United States and redistribute it in a way to the very top. So this reflects policies that have been very damaging to most Americans, but are hidden within an ideology that simply says, well, that's what the market wants. It's not what the market wants. It's what tax policies, labor policies, and a real onslaught against unions has made very possible. There was a poll, the annual Gallup poll on attitudes toward unions was released in mid-August, and I think it's very much instructive. 58% of Americans have a favorable view of unions. How then do we square that with the fact that a little over 6% in the private sector are members of unions? I think one might call that a democracy deficit, and in important measure it reflects the difficulty many workers have in making a free and open choice as to whether or not they want to be a union member and then acting on it. So this reflects policy, corporate attitudes, and a diminishing of democracy, because making the decision to join or not to join a union is a fundamental democratic right, and unions give us the checks and balances that are essential to a functioning democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. So in terms of losing all of these manufacturing jobs, which are heavily unionized, and the demise of labor unions, which is, again, didn't happen by accident, if there is a way to revive a manufacturing economy, would... I mean, is that practical? The problem with all these new jobs, and the president, you know, does always tout these new numbers. The unemployment's gone down to a record low now, but he skips over the fact that jobs may have come back, but wages haven't. And I understand a lot of that's to do with the new kind of jobs that are being created, which are largely in the service sector, but they're more often than not unionized, and only a fraction of what manufactured industrial workers used to get in Detroit and other places up until 1977 or thereabouts, from 47 to 77. That's when the great American middle class was born. That's when the American dream was hatched. Are those days, is it possible to revive them?
Oh, I think important elements of that absolutely can be revived. It's not to say that we aren't overwhelmingly a service economy. We are. We are an economy that uses a lot more information technology and has generated much innovation and many jobs in that area. That's all positive, or could be positive, but that's not to say manufacturing is simply a relic that we're phasing out. Manufacturing is a vital part of any advanced economy, in part because it contributes a huge amount to research and development and information and sectors like information technology. Also, manufacturing has a very high multiplier, meaning each manufacturing job supports about 7 other jobs throughout the economy. So that is very much critical to economic growth. Well, you might say, isn't that a little utopian? Isn't that simply wishful thinking? Not at all. One only has to look at Germany and the success of that economy with a very vibrant, export-oriented manufacturing base and very high wages to understand this is very possible. Does that mean we will be a manufacturing-based economy? Not at all, but it does mean manufacturing could be playing a significantly larger role that would be healthy for the economy overall.
And of course, Germany is now taking in about 1 million Syrian and Iraqi refugees, which in contrast to, say, Hungary, that's treating the refugees in an appalling way, the Germans are welcoming them. Presumably, they're able to employ them as well.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons they've been able to be so welcoming. I think they deserve enormous credit. What they have done morally, what they have done for the fate of other human beings at a moment of deep crisis is truly exceptional. But having a healthy economy lessens the kind of antagonism that might arise to something like that. They're far from out of the water, but they've really shown what can be done. This is a country of 80 million people accepting 800,000 refugees so far. That would be for the U.S. the equivalent of accepting 3.2 million refugees. And we have to remember as recently as last summer when we had 42,000 unaccompanied children from Central America, we had what appeared to be a huge political crisis on our hands. That was wildly unwarranted then, and what Germany and Austria in the last day or two have really brought to our attention is how possible a moral act in a deeply disturbed world right now, how important that is and how possible it is. And that was reinforced by the Pope's comments in the last day or two and by his calling on the Catholic Church to begin housing refugee families. So there are some responses out there that are pretty inspiring and directly related to Labor Day.
Well, it seems without political gridlock, it's virtually impossible to get anything done. And we even had incidents where the government's been shut down and possibly could happen again in this sort of trench warfare over the budgets, which are the amazing thing about the budget is that the Republicans simply will not invest in infrastructure. They will not invest in human capital. They will not invest in anything to move the economy, to stimulate the economy, and to build America and to repair its crumbling infrastructure. The only thing that they will invest in and they'll throw money at, and that is the military-industrial complex. So how do you break that lock? Because interest rates are at an all-time low, which means that this is the perfect time to borrow to repair the roads, rails, and bridges in this country that would put a lot of people to work, create really good, high-paying, middle-class jobs, etc., and do the very things that we were talking about that happened between 1947 and 1977.
Well, I think that's an excellent at a moment where it is...
Can you repeat that? Sorry, Harley, you dropped out.
We are at a moment where it is absolutely essential to invest in infrastructure. It is urgent. It is urgent to have a competitive economy domestically and even more important to have a competitive economy globally. What the Republicans are doing today is not conservatism. It is a hard right anti-government philosophy masquerading as conservatism. It used to be that these issues were decided pragmatically. We might have strong differences, say, in the 50s or 60s between Democrats and Republicans, but at the end of the day, there was a pragmatic sense that we had to keep the economy working and we needed a politics that did that. After all, the largest public works project in our history was done by Dwight Eisenhower, the interstate highway system. That would be a huge difficulty to do today. So it is essential to get back not to what we have now, which is a gridlock that is paralyzing and in no one's interest, and a more pragmatic policy. And I think that requires cutting through an ideology that appears to exalt the individual and appears to say the market can do no wrong, when in reality, it has little to do with markets, which really need rules to operate effectively, and little to do with individuals, because our individual uniqueness is only made possible by a society that appreciates that. So it's that combination that I think we really have to get back to, and that requires taking this ideology that's being put out there and really, really showing the unfortunate and deeply damaging consequences that are coming out of it.
So just in the last few minutes, shifting from the demise of labor, if you will, on Labor Day, to the sense that, at least that I have, that capitalism itself is not necessarily out of the woods and is not necessarily heading in a direction that's sustainable, because so much of our economy is being financialized by Wall Street, and they just play around with money. They don't produce anything. They just extract wealth and don't create it. And, you know, all the corporations now are buying back their own stock so the CEOs look good. They're parking billions, trillions abroad in profits. There's such a flagrant lack of what you could call economic patriotism going on. You know, Bill Gates' father said, you know, you can't sail two yachts at the same time. So it's reached a point now where I don't think it's necessarily sustainable in the long run that greed is good.
Greed is good is absolutely not sustainable in the long run. And having an extractive economy, as a book that appeared several years ago, Why Nation Fails, points out, for thousands of years we've seen that extractive economies prior to capitalism emerging as a defining economic system simply aren't dynamic, productive economies. But on this Labor Day, I think there is something else that we ought to remind ourselves about. These are very tough times for unions. We've seen the consequences of that. But in the last year or so, we've seen some very bright signs. Unions are aware that it's a moment of crisis and have been acting in some creative, bold, innovative ways. For example, they've returned to their roots as being part of social movements. The Fight for 15, which has transformed the debate and resulted in city ordinances passed for $15 minimum wages in five cities and major increases elsewhere in the country. Unions were the linchpin of those efforts. We've seen things like Working America out of the AFL-CIO, which has reached out to millions of non-union workers where there's a point of agreement with labor's political philosophy. We've seen new attempts to organize in many areas, as difficult as all that is. So it's not simply that labor has declined. The crisis is real, but we are seeing also signs of engagement, moving in new directions, and trying new approaches.
Well, Dr. Holly Shenkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today on this Labor Day.
Thank you. It was very nice to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shenkin, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an historical perspective on labor, income disparity, and race and gender in the workplace.
Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working band blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this Labor Day is Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He directs the PhD concentration in the history of work, race, and gender in the urban world and edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his latest book is Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leon Fink.
Ian, happy to be back with you.
And just to get an historical perspective, since you're an historian of labor, Leon, We're often told that this is the new Gilded Age, given the extraordinary disparity and growing disparity of wealth between the top 1% and the 99%. In an historical perspective, is it worse than the Gilded Age of McKinley?
Actually, just to boast, I have a new book out after the one you last mentioned called The Long Gilded Age. So I've been thinking about that problem. And I think that, you know, it's not, on the one hand, there's more of a substratum of both a welfare state and a more broader-based labor union movement that still is alive and kicking than was true in 1900. On the other hand, I think that the forces of greed, so to speak, that are not so dissimilar from the factors that were there that we identify with the era of the robber barons of the first generation of Carnegie and Rockefeller, Vanderbilts, are still have also become much more sophisticated, and the protection of wealth and inequality is a very sophisticated operation these days.
So, continuing then with the comparisons between this current Gilded Age and the earlier Gilded Age at the turn of the 20th century, are we more of an oligarchy and less of a democracy today?
I think, you know, the different angles one can take on that, you know, we can go back to the fact that in terms of basic democratic access, women didn't have the right to vote. It was an era of Jim Crow in 1900. African Americans had basically been pushed totally out of their suffrage rights by that time after the collapse of Reconstruction. On the other hand, I don't think there was anything like the narrowness of access to at least national politics based on money that there is today, that you had local politicians with the following in those days whose access to power was built up more through political machines than just corporate gifts or individual. There was no individual like a Donald Trump who exercised the kind of role in national politics that figures like that do today.
So again, I'm speaking with Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He directs the PhD concentration in the history of work, race, and gender in the urban world and edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. And his latest book is The Long Gilded Age. So the difference, though, today would be surely, Leon, that globalization has become the excuse for lowering people's wages, you know, and at least back in the original Gilded Age, even though American workers were paid appallingly, they nevertheless didn't have to compete with Bangladesh.
That's true. Not only that, but at the level of group self-interest in the old Gilded Age, American business interests actually took the opposite position that many do today, in the sense that they were protectionist. They were trying to shield the American market from the cheaper imports, especially from Britain, and therefore they supported tariffs. Whereas today, American business being so really dominated by multinational or transnational corporations looks for the cheapest markets anywhere to produce, and then supports trade agreements like the TTP or going back to NAFTA that bring back into this country, you know, the cheapest produced goods. So there is a difference in the whole calculation, even of the ownership class.
So in terms of the other big economic factor today that is responsible for the fact that wages have been flat in the United States since the late 1970s. But conversely, productivity has gone through the roof. And for the longest time, household income and productivity tracked in parallel. But then, starting with Ronald Reagan, the divergence began where almost all of the gains of productivity went to the very top, and wages have been flat, if not in a slow decline. How does that relate to the broader historical perspective that you've written about in the Long Gilded Age?
Well, I guess I would see a few factors at work there. On the one hand, the period from the late 30s until the early 70s, roughly 1973, 75, were the most egalitarian in this country. And surely one factor, important factor there, was the rise of a mass labor movement that had a real impact on wages and that kept wages tracking alongside productivity. The result was a boom economy in which much of the population could share. And with both the legal assault and business assault on unionism, as you pointed out, in an age of globalization where unions appear to be a nuisance or an obstacle to the operation of the free market, that break on any kind of countervailing power that would keep that egalitarianism going has really been swept away. And I think that's part of the unevenness or the disequilibrium of today's economy.
Well, Oxfam did a study fairly recently that found that only 85 families on this planet control half of the planet's wealth. It's the equivalent to the half of the entire population of the Earth. So this is not just an American phenomenon, isn't it, this income inequality?
No, that's right. I think basically the period that I was addressing, roughly to the late mid-70s, 80s, was an era in the West of rising social democracy, of a relative egalitarianism, or basically all these countries, these capitalist countries, these market-based countries, were doing very well, but they were effectively, because of the political system and the union movement, they were effectively kicking back a good share of the dividend back into welfare payments and or higher wages. With the globalization, basically the floodgate, especially for manufacturing, towards much cheaper bases of operation began. What had been more just extracting raw materials from the third world then changed to using third world or the global south as a base for manufacturing at a much cheaper level. And that really undermined the manufacturing-based welfare systems of the West.
But surely the part of the story here in terms of the U.S. being among the few developed industrial economies that doesn't have a social democracy, arguably, as you've pointed out, there was a social democracy certainly from 1944 to 1977 and earlier, as you pointed out. But I would say that one of the reasons we don't have a social democracy is because of the power of money over politics and the way that the tax burden has been shifted from the rich to the middle class and the working Americans. I mean, the payroll tax instituted under Ronald Reagan is a perfect example of that. Why is it that in America the average worker doesn't understand that simple concept that social democracies function by, which is you pay your taxes and you get your government services? We get precious little for our taxes and very few government services, and those that we get, like Social Security and Medicare, are constantly under assault.
No, I had the enjoyable experience of just having returned from a half year in Berlin. So, and I traveled some in Europe, and all those countries, European countries, they pay a bit more taxes to be sure, but they get a whole lot more for their money than do Americans. And as a result, working people and well into what we would call the middle class here enjoy good schools, good transportation, relatively secure health care, retirement benefits that only the super rich in the U.S. can enjoy. So I think that in the U.S., in part, these are deeply set cultural patterns, but I think the fear of job loss, especially in localities. We don't have a national planning system for our economy. We have locally based enterprises, and they're competing state against state, city against city, and there's a constant threat if you promise in Chicago to, you know, to raise wages or to maintain union conditions that Wisconsin, you know, is going to steal your jobs, you know, with a anti-union, low-tax regime. So this goes on continually, and the result is rather pathetic.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Leon Fink, give us a sense of, at least in this political season, we're seeing right-wing populism with Donald Trump and left-wing populism with Bernie Sanders. Obviously, there are completely different working-class narratives at play there. But is there anything that gives you some hope and optimism?
Well, there is, because I think the center is not holding. That is, the notion that the U.S., that we have all of these deep-set beliefs and nothing can change is, I think, under threat. I think it's threatening this established assumptions and even power structures of the last few decades, that Trump and even these right-wing populists, so-called, really do threaten the structure of the Republican Party. And I think Sanders, with a full-scale, authentic populism from the left, ultimately, I mean, they haven't begun to open up their artillery on him yet, but ultimately, I think his campaign, you know, he's read Thomas Piketty. He knows that only a tax on wealth, only some redistribution of power can restore a decent standard of living to most Americans. I think not only this political campaign, but at the workplace level, campaigns that seem to have come out of nowhere, at least not from the established trade union centers, like the fight for $15 an hour wage for service workers, is getting tremendous support. So I think there is a hunger for, and there is a kind of grassroots awakening. What form that will take politically remains to be seen, but even within the precincts of the center, you know, more established power, like, you know, certainly Hillary Clinton would be a representative of that, the kind of liberal center, has clearly had to make some moves in that direction to try to conciliate these new forces. So I think that's something to be very positive about on Labor Day.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Leon Fink.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He directs the PhD concentration in the history of work, race, and gender in the urban world and edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, and Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. And his latest book is The Long Gilded Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.